You're listening to the London Buddha Centre, talks and seminars from our home in Bethnal Green, exploring Buddhism in a way that is relevant to contemporary life.
I spent a few weeks mulling over Padmasambhava. He's been in my imagination constantly. I've been thinking about him. I tried to write a talk about him, and I gave up in disgust this morning. Because I was suffering, I realised, from mental congestion. And that was no basis from which I could communicate. So I decided to scrap everything and start all over again. And I'm starting all over again here and now. Now, I did bring along this Tesco bag with me. It is a Tesco bag, you probably can't see, but it's a Tesco bag. Because I might use it at some point, although I think that it's unlikely now. I did have a sort of scheme in mind, but as I say, I've cast that to the wind. So this may or may not get used. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to wing it. Now, this needs to be distinguished from legging it. I did think about legging it, but I don't quite have that kind of gall, unlike one of my contemporaries. So I remember I used to leg it frequently. there was a famous occasion when at Pavloka, he was part of a three-man symposium, chaired by Bante. And he was the final speaker. And I don't think I was speaking on this occasion, but anyway, on this occasion, Subhuti was his eye, yeah, the eagle-eyed Subhuti had roamed the room. Where is he? This was at the point that Bante had got up to summarise the previous talk and was about to introduce the absent speaker. So Subhuti jumped up, raced outside, legged it to this man's room, where he found on his desk a note saying, "Gone to Norwich." So he raced back into the shrine room just as Bante was about to introduce the speaker, who will have to remain anonymous, when Subhuti sort of wrote a very hurried note and handed it to him. And Bante paused. He said, "Oh, our speaker is not here. Well, I suppose I'm going to have to say something about going beyond good and evil." I'm not sure I have anything to say about this topic. But he did manage to pull something out of the bag after about, I don't know, he spoke for about 20 minutes or so and rounded things off. So, this contemporary of mine legged it more than once. I don't have quite that kind of gall. I'd rather just stand here. And if the words don't come, you can stand and look at me. Sit and look at me. And I'm not a pretty sight. I'm getting rather old. But anyway, it's what you've got. Now, just to make sure, because I really don't know where I'm going with this talk, just to make sure that I keep going somehow, I see, fortunately, there are a number of order members in the room. And you may just find that I might look at one of you and say, "Question." Which means you will have to stimulate me to keep on going. I'm sure you can manage that. Hopefully it won't be necessary. But this is also a skillful means. You see, order members are terrors at not listening to other people's talks. So if they think they might be called upon to participate, they'll have to keep their wits about them. I am well known to be merciless as well as kind and courteous. So yes, I'm winging it, not legging it. And order members, watch out. Now, I said I don't know where I'm going with this talk, and honestly, this is true. I mean, my mind is an absolute sea of thoughts and recollections and images this morning. And it's been jam-packed with these for days now, and I really have to push them all to one side. But when I realised, well, I'm going to have to just stand up and speak, something immediately occurred to me, which was that I remember on one occasion Bante quoted Oliver Cromwell to the effect that a man never flies so high as when he doesn't know where he's going. So whether I fly high or low, time will reveal. But at least I did think, well, I've got a starting point. My starting point is this shrine room this morning. I was here at 7 o'clock, community meditation time. Nobody else was. You have 22 men upstairs. I was sitting there alone, wondering, where are they? There are no holidays in the spiritual life, and there are certainly no honeymoons. So here I was, sitting down alone in the shrine room. Actually, perfectly happy to be on my own, but wondering, well, why aren't more of them here? Anyway, we won't go into that now. That's a point for another occasion. Just thought I'd mark it. So I had this beautiful shrine room to myself. I had this beautiful shrine to myself. I was looking at the image of Padmasambhava. And, of course, my thought was still, I beg your pardon, my talk, or my non-talk, was still in my mind. I thought, no, come on, get down and do your practice. So I was meditating. At least I was trying to meditate. Of course, Padmasambhava wouldn't leave me alone. And so eventually what happened was that I had a very strong recollection of something I'd completely forgotten about. And I'm going to tell you this because, in a way, I hope it will communicate something about Padmasambhava, or at least about my interaction or my connection with Padmasambhava. So what happened was this. I guess this was about what would have been over 20 years ago. And my girlfriend at the time, I did have one then. I've had very few, by the way. Most of my life I've been single. But I had a girlfriend at this time. And she was, it wasn't quite certain, but it was. They thought at the hospital that was treating her that she had ovarian cancer. And she spoke with me quite frankly about this and sort of spelt out the implications to me. And I was devastated. I felt deeply, deeply insecure. The fact that she could die, which she didn't yet, as it happens, but it was the reality of the moment. She could die, I could lose her. And at that moment, I didn't feel that I could, well, I didn't want to face the prospect of life without her. And that night, when I went to bed, I was in a state of blind terror. I don't know why, but the extent of the insecurity with which surged up was extreme. And I remember thinking, God, if this goes on, I'm going to lose my mind. And so I invoked Padmasambhava, and I inwardly recited his mantra. I did it all night long. In fact, I had no choice, because I felt as if my mind could split into 1,000 splinters at any moment. And the only thing that was keeping it sane, the only thing that was keeping it together, was the mantra. And so all night long, I just kept that mantra going. And by the time morning came, the insecurity, the sense of insecurity, the fear, the terror, if you like, began to subside. Later that day, I was talking with one of my fellow community members, just when I was living in Birmingham, Maji Maloka, and he said to me, "You invoked Padmasambhava." Well, that was a pretty dumb thing to do. I said, "Well, I had to hang on to something." He said, "Well, what's wrong with Tara?" Tara is the savioress. If you invoke Padmasambhava when you're experiencing already intense fear, it will only increase it. I don't know if this is true, by the way, but this is what he said. I hadn't really thought about it like that, but I suppose there's probably some degree of truth in it, because what Padmasambhava represents is a willingness to face adversity, certainly, and fear. In fact, more than that, a willingness even to go out and seek it and face it. So that's quite possible that as a consequence of doing that, it actually served to intensify my fear. We'll come back to this issue a bit later. But I should really say something about Padmasambhava, since it is, after all, Padmasambhava Day. And I've said something a little bit, but I want to say a bit more. Not too much. I want to somehow more communicate the spirit of Padmasambhava, or what I understand Padmasambhava to be about, rather than give you information, if you see what I mean, about Padmasambhava's life. So I first came along to the FWBO, as we were then, Sri Ratna now, in 1972. And in 1972, sometime that year, just I think before I got there, it's probably July 1972, Bhante gave his talk on Padmasambhava, Tantric Guru of India and Tibet, or Great Tantric Guru of India and Tibet. You can listen to it on Free Buddhist Audio if you wish. It's downloadable. In fact, I would recommend that you do. It's a very, very engaging talk. It's a wonderful talk, actually. But this talk really fired people's imaginations. And when I first came along, Padmasambhava seemed to really loom large. I don't quite know in what way, but in our common psyche or something. He was in the atmosphere, as it were, in the psychic atmosphere. And there are probably a number of reasons for that. But not the least of which was Bhante's own connection with Padmasambhava. He'd always felt personally quite a strong connection with Padmasambhava ever since he first encountered an image, I believe, of Padmasambhava, which he speaks about in this lecture in Darjeeling. And not only that, many of his teachers, his Tibetan teachers, had or felt a strong connection with Padmasambhava, especially those from the Nyingma tradition. But even Dagda Rinpoche, who was not a Nyingma, he was in fact a Gelugpa. And so clearly, Padmasambhava as a Buddhist figure had had a big impact upon Bhante. And he communicated that to us, and he communicated that partly through this talk and some of the talks he gave later that autumn. One of which was the symbolism of the celestial maidens and the cremation ground, which of course was, the celestial maidens being the Dakinis. And inevitably, Padmasambhava was sort of in the background of this material all the time, because Padmasambhava is associated with the cremation ground and with the Dakinis. Padmasambhava would go to the cremation ground and sing and dance with the Dakinis, whatever that meant. Now, in this lecture, Bhante said quite a bit about the symbolism of the cremation ground and what he called the crucial situation. And he also said quite a bit about the Dakinis. And these sort of images of the cremation ground, of the Dakinis, and the Padmasambhava himself loomed large in our consciousnesses, certainly in mine, but also with my closest friends too. We were forever talking about Padmasambhava, it seemed. So Padmasambhava in those days loomed really large in the movement in a way that I don't think he does quite to the same degree now. Of course we're aware of him, otherwise we wouldn't be celebrating this day. But it's not quite the same. It's as if he's receded a little into the background, which in some ways might not be a bad thing, but in many ways I think it's a shame. Because he's such a colourful figure. Such a deeply inspiring figure. Anyway, coming back to this lecture, I mean the one specifically on the symbolism of the celestial maidens and the cremation ground, it fired some of us up in a particular way. Now our centre was in Archway, not very far from Highgate Cemetery. You know, you've got to pay to get in nowadays, but you didn't then. And it was in a very dilapidated state. So one evening, late evening, I found myself climbing the high gates of Highgate Cemetery from the lower end. And I dropped down onto the other side and stealthily disappeared into the heart of the cemetery, looking for a good one. A good grave. A suitable grave to sit down upon and meditate and sing and dance with the Dakinis, whatever that meant. But it didn't work. It didn't work for all sorts of reasons, not the least of which was But it wasn't very dark. And it wasn't quite as light as this, but, you know, I mean, 11 o'clock at night in November, you'd think it could be darker than this. But no, the light pollution around Highgate is terrible. And so I was sitting there in this kind of semi sort of twilight light, really. I didn't feel quite right. And in any case, I was sitting on top of a grave. I mean, the grave was raised off the ground. I couldn't see what was inside it. You know, there's no skulls or bits of flesh lying around, anything like that. The sort of thing you get in cremation grounds, apparently. So that was very disappointing. Anyway, I persisted as best I could. I tried to meditate and kept waiting for the darkness to come. Still nothing happened. Oh, to heck with this. And I just left. A more enterprising contemporary of mine, however, managed to find a vault which was open. Well, at least, strictly speaking, it was closed, but he managed to get inside. So he went inside. I believe it several times, actually. He went inside, closing the door behind him. Of course, it's pitch black in there, I imagine. And he spent the night down there. I don't know what he did. He may have meditated, he may have simply gone to sleep, but he spent the night down there. He spent several nights down there. Unfortunately, this rather enterprising young fellow disappeared. He disappeared with his darkening to Wales, in a manner of speaking. We'll come on to darkenings a little later. But yes, he's no longer with us. He's no longer with us, sadly. But anyway, yeah, that was the sort of thing that we got up to. We used to take Buddhist teaching so seriously. I mean, partly because we were so young. When Bhante gave his lecture on the symbolism of the celestial maidens and the whatever it was, the cremation ground of the celestial maidens, that whole series, I remember it was in Archway. Mangala would have been there. I don't think anybody else was present on that occasion. And we were all seated on the floor in this ex-piano factory now our FWBO centre. It's a bolt upright, hardly moving, as far as I recall anyway. Listening, absolutely gripped by Bhante's delivery, while he talked about these things. And, he was talking effectively not to a group of sub-35s, a group of sub-25s. Sure, there are a few old fogies around in their late 20s and early 30s, but most of us were sub-25. So we were young. We were ardent. We were daring to some degree, I suppose, thinking back at it. And we threw ourselves in to this movement. So we got up to things like that. I think, in a way, we're a little bit wider than perhaps things tend to be these days. Perhaps we need to sort of try and revive some of that wideness a little bit. Things have become a little respectable. We've become a rather respectable Buddhist movement these days. Wasn't quite like that then. I mean, if you saw Bhante delivering a lecture, what would you see? We'd see him standing behind a lecture, this man with long, black, greasy hair streaked with a bit of grey, long sideburns, thick-rimmed glasses, Turkish puzzle rings on his fingers, of course, the inevitable mala around his neck. I think it was a mauve pullover, usually, on top of which there would be an orange robe. Not only that, you could see that the bottom of his long johns were tucked into his socks. You know, the very picture of sartorial inelegance. He's a very fortunate man that he was never seen in this state by either Nyanavacha or Maitreya Bhante, because I can tell you they'd have whipped him off to Lama straight away and got him properly kitted up. I'm not joking. I've been threatened with this myself. I'm not going out with you just like that. Your jacket's too big. That shirt's way too big for you. It works. The shirt works. Doesn't matter if it's too big, I don't care. So we've become a little bit respectable nowadays. Not that I think Nyanavacha is respectable. I'm not suggesting he's respectable.
move on.
But, you know, looking at Banta, as you couldn't see the orange robe, you think, who is this man? You know, looks like a horse trader to me. You know, he definitely looked a little bit disreputable. And I like that. In fact, quite a lot of us did. Because we weren't exactly pro-establishment. And most of the people who used to come along to that centre in those days were hippies. I was not, by the way. I was aloof. I was above all that. I had a career. But certainly I was anti-establishment. And we liked Bante's seeming disreputability, or at least the appearance of that. And there's something about that which sort of is in accord, if you like, with the tantric yogi. The tantric yogi would not be someone bound by conventional morality, or bound by conventions in any way, actually. And Bante certainly wasn't bound by conventional morality, but we'll leave that for the moment. He's not alone in that. For example, If you ever read the songs of Milarepa, it's a wonderful collection of Milarepa's songs translated by Garma C.C. Chang. Is it C.C. or C. Chang? I can't remember. Anyway, basically, Milarepa was Tibet's greatest poet, perhaps even its greatest singer, but certainly its greatest yogi. He was a great tantric yogi, like Padmasambhava, 300 or 400 years after Padmasambhava's time. But reading through that, there's one incident which sort of recurs rather a lot. You see, the Milarepa used to wander around in the snows of Tibet with just a thin cotton robe, nothing else. And it didn't quite cover how nature made him. So his penis was exposed. Now, he had many, many admirers, many patrons. And they really did worship him, they thought he was, you know, the true guru and so on and so forth. But there are several occasions when people come to Milarepa and offer him some, you know, a fuller garment. And the sort of typical response from Milarepa is, you people worry about what is inconsequential and do not concern yourselves with what matters. You're not bothered about cheating people. You're not bothered about telling lies. But look at me. This is how nature made me. What's shameful about that? And so, well, that doesn't quite accord with convention, does it? You don't see people wandering around the streets of this country, certainly, sort of naked. You might see it in India. I've seen it a few times. You know, you do. Because there are naked ascetics wandering around. But it's very, very rare. So this is an example, if you like, of the kind of what the tantric yogi represents. The tantric yogi would not trouble about flouting, if need be, conventional morality. Certainly wouldn't be caught up in it. Would perhaps take it into account if it was a skillful thing to do, if it was necessary to do, if the situation demanded that that was the best thing to do. But in itself, tantric yogi would see, no, these things don't matter. Nakedness doesn't matter. It's not a matter of ethics. So there's something disreputable about the tantric yogi. There's something disreputable about Padmasambhava. There's something even disreputable about anyone, perhaps, who takes the Dharma very seriously. Because you're not bound. Or you may refuse to be bound by conventional morality. You may take it into account. Sometimes you have to. In fact, very often you do. Most of the time, perhaps you do. But sometimes, you'll go against it. And you won't worry about what other people think. So that's an aspect of the tantric yogi, of this tradition, which I found very, very appealing and inspiring. So there's something of that communicated itself with Bante when I first came across him, especially when I was listening to those lectures. But there's something about that which is part of what it means to be a tantric yogi, it seems to me. And Padmasambhava is the tantric yogi par excellence. He's the great tantric guru of India and Tibet. Padmasambhava, we know very little about him, about his life really. There's a lot of myth surrounding him, there's a lot of legend, and up with him. But the only thing, or well, there's a few things that we do know for certain, are that he went to Tibet. He went to Tibet in the year 750. He was invited to go there by Shanta Rakshita, a very scholarly monk from Nalanda in India, who had been invited previously to Tibet to help establish Buddhism there. But he had problems with the local gods. And these problems were beyond his capacity, as he well knew. He was a great scholar, even regarded as a great bodhisattva, but he's not able to deal with the anger of the Tibetan gods. And so he called Padmasambhava to fix it. Padmasambhava only stayed for 18 months, but by the time he left, he had subdued the gods of Tibet, we're told, converted them to the Dharma, and even converted them to the point that they became protectors of the Dharma in Tibet. Now, what all that means, symbolically and so forth, I'm going to leave you to work out for yourselves. In fact, better still, go to that lecture, Padmasambhava, Tantric Guru of Tibet. You get a very, very full and inspiring account of all that in that lecture. So this is something of the spirit which appealed to so many of us in those days, certainly to me, very, very strongly. But let's come back to the cremation ground, because this is a crucial tantric image, and it's an image which has had a huge impact upon me. When I heard that lecture from Bhante, I was deeply inspired by it. And the idea of the cremation ground, or its symbolism, what it meant in terms of experience, what it meant in terms of practice, is something I've tried to take to heart as fully as I can. Often I've failed, but I've tried to take it to heart. What the cremation ground implies, perhaps above all else, is the heroic dimension of Buddhist practice. Now, we all know that Buddhism has a wonderful and well-deserved reputation, for the most part, for being a peaceable, non-violent tradition. If you like, a tradition of love and peace. And it certainly is that. It's that very deeply. But there's much more to it than that. There's the whole heroic dimension of Buddhist practice, which is implied by the lives of the great Buddhists, which you can see in the life of the Buddha himself. For example, the Buddha was always compared to strong, powerful animals, like the bull, the lion, the tiger, the elephant, nothing meek, nothing gentle like the lamb. So that gives you some idea of this other dimension to Buddhist practice and to what it means to become a Buddhist, what it means even to gain enlightenment. It calls for a tremendous effort of courage, I suppose. I mean, it's not that long ago, the turn of the 20th century, when you still had Theravadan monks in Thailand deliberately walking down jungle paths at night, knowing that sooner or later they would encounter tigers. Presumably they went down those paths to face their own fear, but more than face it, to help them overcome it. Again, there's a wonderful account of all this in a book which is on sale in the bookshop, sounding increasingly like a salesman, aren't I? Forest Recollections. You'll find it, it's on display in the bookshop at the moment. A very, very inspiring Buddhist book. I can highly recommend it. And it'll give you some sort of feel for this dimension of Buddhist practice. So as Buddhists, we're encouraged to develop the heroic virtues. The virtues of self-reliance, complete self-reliance. That is to say, you're able to live, if need be, completely alone, survive alone. Doesn't mean that we don't have spiritual friends, that we don't develop Kalyanamitrata, but that you're willing and able to face life alone if need be. And the proof of that, of course, is whether or not you can go happily into solitude. You can go on a long solitary retreat, like for weeks. That's a big test of how self-reliant you can be. In the early days, actually, I remember Bante saying that he thought that anyone who wanted to be ordained should do at least a one-month solitary retreat beforehand. We don't ask for that nowadays, of course, but he certainly thought that all of us, all order members, should do at least a month's solitary retreat every year. And so, again, a lot of us would do that at that time. I've done solitary retreats throughout my life. The first one I did was for 5 weeks. I didn't think about it. It was a bit silly, really, but I just plunged in. I was young, foolish, and ardent. And I had to learn the hard way. And I don't regret it either. It was very hard. It was very hard indeed. And the biggest problem I had was dealing with boredom. What do you do with boredom? You know, a 26-year-old man for a month, 5 weeks on his own, in a hut, a sort of cottage in the Welsh hills, in December. It's hardly any light, lots of drizzle. No sun. What do you do? No radio, no books, nothing. Just you and your mental states. It was so tedious. It was so boring. And then, of course, as other things creep in, like you start getting nervous, the fear starts to creep in. The first week of that solitary retreat, I'll never forget. It was just like, I felt the nerves building on the first day, and it built and built and built and built. And so after 6 days, I was a nervous wreck. And finally, it built up to a crescendo, as it often does in situations like this, when you're upstairs in a cottage on your own, and there's a noise downstairs. And it's dark. It's night time. Who is it? What is it? You don't know. Of course, it's just a mouse. But mice can be very, very noisy when you're alone. You've no idea. They sound like elephants sometimes. on one occasion, it induced such strong terror in me, I actually couldn't breathe. I felt the pressure pushing up into my chest, and I was actually gagging. I sat bolt upright in bed. I said, "I don't care who's there." It all just dispersed. So, yeah, that was quite a relief. And fear then did not trouble me on solitary retreats for quite a long time after that. It crept in my 9-month retreat. That was an epic deal. I'm not going to bore you with that now. I may give a separate talk on that sometime soon. But if you go into solitude, you almost certainly you'll have to contend with this sort of thing. Some degree of fear is almost inevitable, it seems. So many of us have had this experience, but it's a way of helping you to deal with it, helping you to overcome it. It's a way of confronting it too. But think about the tantric yogis. They didn't just go into solitude. Solitude for them would be a cave, not a hut, a Gujaloka, or a cottage in Wales. They'd stay in a cave, alone, in the jungle perhaps, or near the jungle. And they just meditate in that cave. This is what Milarepa did. All his life, most of his life, Milarepa was sitting in a cave, meditating. Of course, he had many disciples that would come to him, but he wandered from cave to cave. No life of luxury and comfort and ease, such as we enjoy at Gujaloka. Not that there's that much there, but compared to the Milarepa, it's quite luxurious. At least you've got a bed to sleep on, not a rock. the tantric yogis would go into solitude, but they'd also go and seek the cremation grounds. And they'd meditate in the cremation grounds, because the cremation grounds would induce fear on an unprecedented scale. Because in the cremation ground, I mean, there are very few cremation grounds, if any, left in India now, but they were apparently fairly common. In the cremation ground, certainly at the time of Padmasambhava and the great tantric yogis of that period, the cremation ground would include, sometimes people just left bodies there. They didn't even burn them. Just left them there to rot. So there'd be rotting corpses in the cremation ground. There'd be charred bones. There'd be bits of flesh. And the yogis would deliberately go there on a moonless night and sit in the midst of it all, preferably on top of a corpse, a rotting corpse, and meditate and see what that does to their minds. Perhaps you can imagine. It would take strong nerves. It's bad enough in a heart in Guhya Loka without going to those lengths. But there's a great value, see, in trying to face and overcome your fear. And this is what the tantric yogis would do, quite consciously, deliberately. They didn't wait for fear to come to them. They went and sought it, and they faced it. If you go into a solitary retreat of any significant duration, you might find, well, in fact, when I went to Guhya Loka for my 9-month retreat, I expected it to happen, and sure as hell it did. It didn't take long to come, and it was very, very tardy in leaving. But eventually it went. Eventually I managed to face it down, but it took quite a lot of effort. So when we speak in terms of transforming consciousness, this is part of it, not the whole story, but it's an important part of it. And this is what the tantric yogis would get up to. They'd go and they'd face their own fear. They'd face even the possibility of insanity. Because just imagine what it's like to be there, in a cremation ground, on a moonless night, on your own. You didn't go with your mates. You went alone. And you just sit there, amidst all that death and destruction. Just sit there, take in the atmosphere. Perhaps sitting on top of a corpse. What would that do to your mind? I can imagine what it would do to mine, because why I've never gone that far. And why, in this life at least, I think it's unlikely I ever will. Unfortunately, I will not have the opportunity because there are no cremation grounds anymore. But just imagine, that's what the tantric yogis did. So what the cremation ground represents, symbolically, is what Bhante called the crucial situation. The crucial situation is one in which you deliberately seek out a circumstance or a situation which is going to force you to grow. Almost live, or grow or die. Almost that sort of situation. That's the sort of situation that the tantric yogis put themselves into. Perhaps we don't have to go to such extremes, I'm sure we don't. There are plenty of crucial situations also for us. In fact, we're living in one, we just don't see it. The samsara itself is a cremation ground. People are born and die. We all die sooner or later. Death's right in your face. You can't escape it in this life of ours. And sometimes it's a bit more in your face than you care for. I was in India earlier this year for 5 months, end of last year, beginning of this. And in some ways, it was one of the most difficult visits I've ever made. And India is never easy, particularly. I was teaching at Nagaloka, where we have a very large centre, where we teach 8-month Dharma courses to young Dalits, that is to say, followers of Dr. Ambedkar, ex-members of what are called the ex-untouchable community. They prefer, they prefer to be referred to as Dalits, or at least as belonging to scheduled castes. But whilst I was there, the daughter, 21-year-old daughter, of one of my longest-standing friends in India, hanged herself. And she was quite often around at Nagaloka, so all the students knew her. It deeply shocked everybody. But in India, of course, when someone dies, you don't put their body in a coffin. You put it on a bier, and you cover that bier with flowers, so the body's submerged in flowers, but you leave the face exposed, and then you carry that bier down to the burning ghat. And so going down on this particular trip, on this particular occasion, I went to the funeral, I went down to the burning ghat, I followed with several hundred other people, I followed the bier down to the burning ghat and watched her body be consumed by all the flames that were writhing around it. And when you actually see something like that, it brings the fact of death much more closer to you. It becomes a much more immediate reality, which I think is a very, very positive thing. Sometimes it's not the sort of thing that we want to talk about or want to think about, but nonetheless, ultimately, that's where we're all headed. We're all headed for the cremation ground, or at least the crematorium or the graveyard. That's where it all ends. And my time is not that far off now. I'm 67. Can't be that far off. I mean, I don't know how long I've got, but certainly there are signs that my body is beginning to give way. You notice certain things just don't work quite in the same way. I've got high blood pressure now. I've had a carcinoma removed from my arm in India, the last visit, and so on. So my body is beginning to show signs of cracking up slowly. And this is a very positive experience, I must say. It's not always a reassuring experience, but it's a reminder to me that your time's running out. They're messengers of death, messengers we should listen to, messengers that I need to listen to, perhaps that I need to listen to even more, messengers which bring up yet again this primordial fear which the yogi confronts. But what's interesting about fear is that fear can only arise in dependence upon an ego sense. No ego sense, no fear. If you want to go beyond fear, and I certainly would like to, then you have to go beyond your ego sense. That means going beyond ego clinging. It's a term that Milarepa uses a lot in his songs. Go beyond self-clinging, which is the usual translation of the equivalent term in the Pali canon. You see this page and page and page after page after page in Buddhist texts, the importance of overcoming ego clinging, ego sense. But that is the source of all our fear. No ego, no ego sense, no ego clinging, fear cannot arise. It's the condition upon which fear arises. So the tantric yogi, therefore, goes, ultimately, to overcome that ego sense, to overcome that ego clinging. That is what, in the end, dispenses with the fear. Nothing else can do it. So, the cremation ground and its symbolism, as I say, has had a great impact upon me. It's had a it's been a major source of inspiration for me throughout my life. And this took on a new kind of direction, but a new form for me a few years ago. I don't know how many of you know about what happened in Vietnam in the 1960s, but in 1963, a very highly respected Vietnamese monk, a highly regarded meditation teacher, in fact, called Quang Duc, burnt himself alive in downtown Saigon. It's usually thought, if you ask, there are very, very, very famous photographs of him, iconic images of him burning to death, very, very calmly, in this situation. It's usually thought or believed that he was protesting against the so-called Vietnam War. Had nothing to do with that. The reason he died, the reason he sacrificed his own life, was because in South Vietnam at that time, the Catholic regime was trying to completely exterminate Buddhism from South Vietnam. 75% of the population were, or considered themselves to be, Buddhist. But the regime was Catholic. And they were trying to get rid of Buddhism. They were trying to destroy it. I don't want to tell that story again because I told it here a couple of years ago when I was invited to speak on one of the Dharma nights. But Quang Duc became one of my heroes. In other words, a sort of exemplar for me. Not that I've got any idea or desire, by the way, to burn myself to death. Far from it. I don't wish to do such a thing. I can't think of a worse way of dying. But there probably are worse ways. But I've got no such intention. But I really admire what he did. Because I spent some time researching his life, looking into why he did what he did, looking into the circumstances surrounding his remarkable action. And I came to the conclusion, having spoken with some people who knew him, having spoken with the primary research scholars into his life, that he acted out of compassion. Actually, he also acted out of devotion, I should say, because in his final letters, he wrote about making an offering of himself to the three jewels. That's the way he wrote about it. that's the way, from what I understand from those people who organized this for him, he spoke to them about. He was making an offering of himself to the three jewels. He was not protesting against the government. He wasn't even seeking a change of government. Well, he did leave a letter for the president, simply begging the president to have a more compassionate attitude towards his Buddhist people, to have an equally compassionate attitude towards the Buddhist people as to the Catholic people and everybody else. That's the way he died. So it wasn't a protest, not in the normal sense anyway, even though what he did brought the attention of the world to the plight of Buddhists in Vietnam. And actually did change things. But that didn't seem to be why he did it. But as far as he was concerned, he was making an offering of himself to the three jewels. In other words, he was giving his life for the sake of the Dharma. And ultimately, that's what the Bodhisattva does. That's what at least the Bodhisattva should be prepared to do. Someone who really is serious about leading, or let's say treading the Bodhisattva path. Who wants to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. Now, Quang Duc burnt himself to death. So whenever I used to think about this, immediately what came to my mind was the cremation ground and the crucial situation. The cremation ground because, in effect, he turned his own body into the cremation ground. He sat down and set himself on fire and didn't budge, didn't move throughout the 15 minutes or so that his body was upright before it finally fell back when he was dead. He didn't move, he didn't flinch, he just sat through it, he just endured it for the sake of others, for the sake of preserving Buddhism in Vietnam. So he effectively created a cremation ground of his own body. But it was a crucial situation, and well, that was certainly a crucial situation for him. If the crucial situation is one in which you either live or die, I mean, in his case, he was going to die, whatever happened. But there are deaths and deaths, and there's life and life. But he was faced with a challenge, which he rose to, from which he didn't flinch. But also, it wasn't just his personal issue. It was a crucial situation for Vietnamese Buddhism. And he recognized that something drastic needed to be done. And he did it. He had the courage and the imagination to do it. So again, this is something of the heroic spirit which is suggested by the imagery of the cremation ground and by the tantric yogi, which to some extent is embodied by the figure of Padmasambhava. I'm beginning to run out of time and some of you are beginning to look rather tired. I think I'd better stop. There's quite a bit more that I could say. As usual, when you speak without notes, you never quite know when to stop. So I like to keep my clock in my hand so I don't go way over time. But I think I better stop there. I don't think you can take any more of this. It's pretty hardcore stuff. But thank you for listening.
You've been listening to the London Buddha Centre. Make sure to press the subscribe button. And then please take a moment to rate and review this podcast. It really helps other people to find us. Thank you.